The world's largest democracy is holding elections right now. And even though India is thousands of miles away, many Illinoisans are paying close attention. Plus, are you trying to cut back on meat? Well, there's a growing market for burgers that taste like it and look like it, but are entirely plant-based. Even Burger King's starting to cash in. And as you ready your garden for spring, how ready is it to attract pollinators? How to grow gardens that are friendly to bees and butterflies?
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, we're talking about the new fake meat trend that even Burger King is picking up on and testing just across the border in St. Louis. And we're going to be talking about how to turn your yards and gardens into places that pollinators want to be. As always, we want to hear from you on these issues. You can text your questions or comments to 217-394-5765. Save that number. You can always text us there, 217-394-5765. But first, elections are currently being held in the world's largest democracy. 900 million people in India are eligible to cast ballots in this year's elections. Voting is actually taking place right now and will continue until May 19th. The ballots will be counted on the 23rd. There's a lot at stake in India's elections. The results affecting, of course, not just Indian residents, but South Asians and people around the world, including right here in Illinois. Asian Americans are the fastest growing demographic in our state and in our country. And within that, here in Illinois, South Asians are the largest of that group. There are more than a quarter of a million, about 270,000 residents of South Asian descent in Illinois. The Hindu World Congress was actually even held in Lombard last year. But so many Illinoisans, whether it's university students in Champaign-Urbana or longtime diaspora members whose parents immigrated from India to Chicago a generation ago, are keeping an eye on how this goes. We've gathered a few of those people in Illinois who are watching closely. Harish Patel is joining us now from Chicago, where he's the founder of Chicago Votes Action Fund. Dipesh Chakrabarty is a distinguished professor of South Asian history at the University of Chicago. And Rashid Emmett is the former president of the U.S. Policy Institute. U.S.-India Policy Institute. He's also former president of the Indian American Muslim Council, joining us from the Chicago suburbs. Harish, Dipesh, Rashid, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having us on this program.
Dipesh, I wonder if we could start with you. I think even thinking about an election on this scale is hard for a lot of us to comprehend. And I wonder how the sheer size of India affects this political process and the vote.
Well, size and if you think about the history of the place, if you think of all the nations that became independent in the 50s and 60s, in that phase of decolonization, India is one of the few countries that have survived intact, you know, barring a few places that's been kind of nibbled away by China. It's one place that has, even Pakistan didn't survive intact because East Pakistan became Bangladesh. And it survived in spite of poverty, in spite of a lot of, you know, lack of literacy. Situations have improved. But when India decided to go in for universal adult franchise, in 1950 after independence, it was a momentous historic decision. And on the whole, I think the decision has sort of proven to be the right decision. It's held the country together. It's pushed it forward. There are many problems, but overall, Indian democracy is a huge thing. 900 million people, that's like more than the population of European Union. And voting in seven phases within India, it's often called it's called the Festival of Democracy. It's festive, it can get violent, it produces a lot of political jokes and interest on television, on the streets. It's very dramatic, and what really at stake, I think, for India in elections and governance and all those things is the fact that, of the 1.3 or a billion people that India has, more than half are under 25. So it's a very young population, and employment is a huge issue. Employment or unemployment, however you want to put it.
Right. So in that sense, it's a lot of thinking about people voting about the economy is pretty similar to thinking
about the economy. About there are many issues actually in the election, but surely the economy was one. Not just its growth, but also a growth creating jobs, but also things like terrorism, things like corruption, things like nationalism, things like dynastic political rule, things like Hindu nationalism, question of minorities, how they will be treated, question of freedom of the press, institutions. A lot of these things are there at play.
Well, and even I think the conversation around, for example, as you said, freedom of the press and fake news is a conversation that's happening. I think
fake news is a huge, big thing. Yeah.
That's a big problem in India.
The volume goes up.
So as we're talking to Dipesh Chakrabarty, Harish Patel, Rashid Ahmed is also with us. Rashid, I wonder if you can help us understand how important, everyone always says this election is the most important. But when it comes to India, how important do you think this election is?
Thanks, Naila, for choosing this topic. This is an important topic, not just for India, for the region and any other democratic country, I guess. This election is important because after 70 years, this is the first time which the election most likely would decide whether India will continue on the path of secularism and, as Dipesh mentioned, a festival of democracy that means everybody participates in it enthusiastically and the adult franchise in India is single most common thread in so diverse country from so many perspectives, caste, religion, economic status, geography, rural, urban, so many ways, so many diverse languages. The only thing which brings India, all Indians together is election. So this election would decide if India will continue its pathway that the founding fathers of India had set. That is, secularism in the sense not that religion is out, but all religions are equal. And it's not that there is a hidden agenda of some party that wants to undermine the democracy, but it is an open discussion. Even with the current party ruling, it may not have come from the top guy, but it has come from many of the party's functionaries and actual candidates who are running for various.
Right. So, Rashid, you're talking about the BJP, and that's the Prime Minister Narendra Modi's party. He swept to power in 2014 with the first outright majority. India is a parliamentary system of government, and it was the first outright majority in 30 years. Harish, I wonder, as I'm just thinking about, you and I were talking before we went on air. Obviously, you were really involved in the Chicago mayoral election. That was a local election you were paying a lot of attention to. How important do you think this Indian election is? Do you agree with Rashid as he's talking about this is a question about whether India's current path to democracy continues? Do you think it's that crucial?
I would agree with both Rashid and the professor Dipesh, who spoke before. I do think that there's a feeling and anxiety among a lot of the minority groups in India around sort of the change in not only tangible ways that they are represented in the media, in government, how they feel about their chances, but also that they don't feel like they're a full citizen of India under the new government. And I think part of it is the things that they were mentioned around sort of anti-Christian, anti-Muslim, small minority groups feeling that. I think that's going to have an impact also on participation in the democratic process. The part for me that's interesting is that Modi, the current prime minister, came into power in 2014, but we have seen this sort of populist, sort of more of a right-wing leadership taking power all over the world. So for me, as somebody sitting in Chicago looking at the Indian election, I'm not only thinking about India as an Indian election, but also sort of the strong arm government and how things in Brazil with Bolsonaro or Erdogan or Putin or Trump or Netanyahu in Israel, how that plays out with Modi sort of being strongly in favor of that sort of politics, right? So we've seen that. At the same time, there is impressive resistance in those countries, just like there's impressive resistance and response in India.
Mm. Dipesh Chakrabarty is also with us. He teaches South Asian history at the University of Chicago. I wonder if you can explain to us a little bit about Prime Minister Modi's success. And I should note, we actually reached out to all four Midwest National Board members of the Overseas Friends of the BJP several times to invite them to join us today. We did not get a response. But I wonder if you can explain a little bit about, as Harish is talking about, India's diversity, but how much the message of the BJP has been about, if the question is India now should be considered maybe a Hindu country versus something else?
So let me just say that, you know, in terms of BJP's election rhetoric, this election in 2019, the rhetoric is quite different to what the rhetoric was when they came into power in 2014. So in 2014, they focused on corruption of the previous Manmohan Singh-led government. They focused on jobs. They focused on bringing black money illegally held in overseas banks back into India. They promised more income for farmers. Farmers' distress in India has been horrible. You know, thousands of farmers commit suicide every year. Since 2001, they've been doing it. And so the rhetoric was very much, and Modi was promoted as what they called in English, in Hindi, Vikas Purush, meaning Mr. Development. Whereas this particular election, the emphasis from the BJP side is more on a masculine nationalism, more on questions of security, questions of terrorism, kind of the threat of Pakistan or Pakistan-sponsored terrorism. So interestingly, I agree with both Rashid and Harish that the rhetoric's changed, and the rhetoric in these elections, the emphasis on masculine Hindu nationalism can give rise to worries.
Mm.
And concerns.
And when we think about the U.S.-India relationship, Rashid, I wonder how you think that relationship has been when we think about Prime Minister Modi, President Trump. He and Prime Minister Modi, although President Trump isn't necessarily known for getting along with many leaders of other foreign countries, he certainly actually gets along quite well with Prime Minister Modi, correct?
Yeah, I mean, at least at some level, yes. I think the U.S.-India relationship is mostly based on the business interests that includes a lot of defense needs India has and interested in acquiring the defense technologies and the business interest, U.S. business interest in India, in a growing economy. So that layer, it is going on, and I think that there is not much disruption. Maybe there are some hiccup here and there, what Obama had started or what even Bush had started with Manmohan Singh when he was prime minister. That is continuing, and I think the primary barrier or difficulty is India's own regulations. U.S. Businesses, corporate sector is not yet totally comfortable with investing in India because of its internal business practices and obviously the corruption, which is there is a systematic corruption issue there, which undermines the quality. What happens there, and then the investors get worried about whether it is a stable country, country is not. They are very interested in investing in India. They do, but they have a sense of hesitation and let's wait and see how it goes, because there are other markets too. So they kind of hedge it very carefully. So that level, those relations are going well. And as far as the human rights violations and all that in India, U.S. doesn't care because we know U.S. does business with China with so much human rights violations going on. So I don't think on that level there is any in difficulty. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of negotiation.
And I wonder, Dipesh, if we can think about, certainly we've heard Prime Minister Modi talk about India first, how much that's varies. He actually was saying India first before President Trump was saying America first, but that's a pretty common refrain we hear from him, correct?
He had this slogan, Make in India, which I don't think it's made much progress. I mean, the reason why I think the BJP has moved on to talking about nationalism and security and terrorism and citizenship bill, where they would give preference to non-Muslims coming as refugees to India and give them Indian citizenship, but not to Muslims, you know. The reason why the BJP has been emphasizing this sort of stuff is because the economic record of the last 5 years is not very good. The demonetization of 2016, I think, was a major disaster. The goods and services tax it's produced problems for small business, even though the idea was not bad. And it was unemployment. There was a leaked government report that showed that unemployment probably is at its highest in the last 45 years.
Wow.
There have been all kinds of economists and others have actually expressed doubts about the deteriorating quality of Indian statistics. Globally. So I think BJP is more into managing the optics of what it looks. But I do think that the emphasis on a renewed emphasis on Hinduness, on nationalism and security and terrorism and all of these questions, and not so much on employment and actually even on corruption, has something to do with the fact that if you look at the record for the last 5 years, it's not so wonderful as BJP had imagined it would be in 2014 when they came in.
So it makes sense that they're thinking about how you think they're managing the message. We have to take a break, but when we come back, we'll continue this conversation with a focus as well on what's happening here in Illinois, how much people are making campaign phone calls, things like that here in Illinois for the election that's happening in India as we speak. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. We'll pick up this conversation just on the other side of this short break. Listening to The 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. Right now, we're talking about elections that are happening right now in India, the world's largest democracy. There's actually about more than a quarter of a million residents here in Illinois who are South Asian. We've been just talking about this month-long vote process, actually more than a month-long vote process that's taking place back home in India with a few folks in Illinois who've been watching this closely, including Harish Patel, founder of Chicago Votes Action Fund, who's on the line from Chicago. Harish, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about the political activity here that's related to the election back in India. I'm thinking, for instance, the U.S. chapter of the Overseas Friends of the BJP has had members making campaign calls to people back in India here in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two ways to think about it. One, there has been a rise of South Asians and Indian Americans just being involved in electoral politics, elections, voting in the United States. So you see appointments made by presidents or, in state officials sort of including Asian Americans, South Asians, and Indian Americans within that framework. So there is political power there. That is one to keep in mind. You will see congresspeople and or senators running for office sort of at least making a call to some of these South Asian leaders. And then the second part of that, which you're sort of talking about, which is the non-resident Indians who are Indian citizens who are living in the U.S. or Europe, who have become quite active in Indian elections. Now, I feel like BJP has done probably the best in engaging the overseas community, specifically in making investments financially into the party. I haven't seen any other party do what BJP has been able to accomplish in an international sort of sense. There are other regional parties that I have heard of, the Aam Aadmi Party, which was the anti-corruption party that had fundraisers or events in the U.S. to sort of share their messaging. I've seen a representative of the Congress Party who are active locally here as well. So I think as Indian people are getting more involved in U.S. politics, I think there is going to be in direct connection to them being more involved on the Indian side as well. The other piece that I want to sort of allude to, where you mentioned that the issues under Trump with U.S.-India relationship has changed how we navigate or engage with Indian, Indian politics. We used to bring up regional security, freedom of press, religious freedom. Now it has become mostly conversations about business and defense spending. And I think there is, I'm hoping that on the Indian side, that the election changes that narrative and it goes back to talking about freedom of press, freedom of religion, and human rights violation at some point, like we had a little bit more under the Obama administration.
Professor Dipesh Chakrabarty is also with us. He teaches South Asian history at the University of Chicago. Dipesh, I wonder if you can tell us also a little bit about, as Harish is talking about, the South Asian population in Illinois, as we're seeing Asian Americans become more politically motivated, how much you see, whether it's for the BJP or for the Indian Congress Party, how much activity you've seen here in Illinois related to the election?
Well, I agree with Harish that I think the BJP has been the most creative of all Indian political parties in actually reaching out to and engaging the diaspora, not just in this country but globally. Which is that, and that's true. So in that sense, I have not been personally subject to an election campaign on behalf of BJP, but I wouldn't be surprised if there's been fundraising events and things. What I have myself participated in as an academic is forums on Indian democracy and what's happening in Indian politics, where I've had American South Asians, but very much affiliated to BJP, speak on BJP's policies. So, look, let me put it this way. Many people say that Modi has been a very polarizing person, so people either love him or don't like him at all. And I wouldn't be surprised if you saw some kind of polarization along those lines in the community here as well.
Can I just end and just ask you one last question? We just got a comment on Twitter from one of our listeners saying one of the biggest problems in India is that there is no strong opposition party, and for a healthy democracy, you need one. The Congress Party is corrupt to the core, and people, even though they might not be happy with Modi, don't want to vote for the Congress Party. Professor Chakrabarty, I wonder if I could just let you have the last word here as we think about the Indian electorate and how much of apathy there is around either of the major parties, whether it's the Indian Congress Party or the BJP, when it comes to the issue of corruption?
Well, first of all, the participation in the polling process is generally high. It's over 65% generally. So people are generally enthusiastic about the election, and they do take part. And on the whole, I think they're fair and free, with some barring some exceptions. On the voting card, you actually have an option of saying none of the above. You can actually vote for none of the candidates available. But at the same time, I must say that this idea that there is no alternative to Modi because the opposition is so divided, both has a merit to it, has some merit to it, but also becomes part of the campaign for BJP.
Interesting, right. So,
it's a statement that has some objective truth to it, but at the same time, it's a statement that favors, that can end up favoring the BJP and not the Nota option.
So we will see how this unfolds. As we said, voting continues until May 19th. The actual vote doesn't get tallied until the 23rd. I want to thank Professor Dipesh Chakrabarty for being with us. He teaches South Asian history at the University of Chicago. Rashid Ahmed has also been with us, a former president of the U.S.-India Policy Institute and the Indian American Muslim Council. And I want to thank Harish Patel for also being with us, founder of Chicago Votes Action Fund. Gentlemen, thank you for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nyla.
Thank you for having us. Okay. Thanks.
We're pretty close to mealtime here, so I wonder if we can change topics here. Let me get your mouth watering for just a minute. Imagine sitting down to your favorite burger place, toasted bun, crispy lettuce, juicy patty, all stacked up, ready for you to take a big bite, except even though this looks like beef, It might even bleed like beef. It is not beef at all, because plant-based patties are the latest food trend. Burger King's in St. Louis are joining the meatless market with Impossible Whoppers. The name comes from a California company, Impossible Food, which provides plant patties to more than 5,000 restaurants nationwide, including almost 600 here in Illinois. At the same time, companies across the country are developing also lab-grown meat. That's real meat made in a lab from animal cells. Both meatless and lab-grown industries have gained support from consumers concerned about the environmental costs of raising and consuming meat. So are these rapidly expanding markets making the need for beef obsolete? Joining me for more on this is Olga Kazhuzin. She's been reporting on this for The Atlantic. Louisa Chu is also with us. She's a Chicago Tribune food critic, co-host of The Chewing Podcast. Olga, Louisa, thanks for being here. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having
me. Thanks, Nyla.
And we want to hear from you guys if you have ever tried an Impossible or the Beyond Burger or any other of these sort of meat-like, meatless patties. We want to hear from you. You can text us at 217-394-5765. That's 217-394-5765. So, Louisa, we're not just talking about Burger King. They're doing this. They're testing this out in St. Louis. White Castle, Red Robin, both carry Impossible patties. Earlier this year, Taco Bell announced it was testing out a vegetarian menu board. Do you think it's becoming more of an expectation that chains have to become more vegetarian friendly? Are they following a market here?
Absolutely. And certainly not just chains, because one of the most remarkable introductions of the Impossible Burger in the food world certainly was White Castle, because it was very accessible and inexpensive. But you're finding it at just about every fancy burger place, too, where you can get not only with the really over-the-top burgers a giant beef patty, but an Impossible or Beyond Burger option, too.
Right. And Olga, when we're thinking about companies like Impossible Foods, how big is this industry becoming right now?
This is a huge industry. You have a lot of different venture capitalists investing in these companies, both on the lab-grown side and on the plant-based side. And this is just a big market segment also. There's, like, I think something like a quarter of young Americans right now are vegetarian or vegan. So there's definitely a lot of opportunity here.
And when we're thinking about chains, Louisa, I wanted to ask you about Illinois-based McDonald's, because they actually don't have a single meat-free entree. Well, I guess if you count fish, maybe, right? But where do you think McDonald's is? Do you think McDonald's is lagging behind a lot of other folks when it comes to providing meat-free sandwiches for people?
But the French, I actually had a chance to visit McDonald's headquarters in the Chicago area when they opened their restaurant at the big new H2. And that was one of the things that I asked about. And they were very evasive about it. So it is pretty surprising that even places like Burger King, which had the vegetarian burger that was pre-Impossible, pre-Beyond, that's been readily available. So I'm surprised, but I am not at all surprised. I would not be surprised that they're certainly working on that sort of a choice very soon.
So we want to hear from you if you've ever tried one of these, what you think of it. You can text us at 217-394-5765. Louisa, I have consumed many Impossible Burgers. I have varying degrees of opinion about how they taste. What about you?
I have eaten many, too, and I did hear about your varying experiences with the Impossible Burger. But here's the thing, is that like any other food product, it is often at the mercy of the cook. And so even if you go someplace like White Castle, for example, where you can get an Impossible Burger for about $2, you know, it really depends on the cook, the griddle,
They taste like I have to say the Impossible Burgers at White Castle taste like regular White Castle burgers, I think.
They do, for better or worse. And so if you're liking that sort of, and so what I like to recommend is, if possible, get it smashed flat, because it does cook up to a really thin griddled patty with those nice brown lacy edges amazingly well. I'm not a huge fan when those Impossible Burgers are cooked up like a thicker, kind of more of like the grilled patty. So it, like any other food product, it really can vary in terms of, who's cooking it and then how it's presented too.
Olga, I wonder how much of this is about a market for people, and I want to get to the lab-raised meat in a minute here, but how much of it is recognizing people may be becoming vegetarian not for the reasons that people used to become vegetarian? I think a lot of times people thought about moral considerations. I think in the animal treatment, how much are we seeing people now being more concerned about environmental costs, especially when we look at how much meat and beef is consumed in this country?
Absolutely. And that's really what these companies are aiming to capture, is the people who are vegetarian or vegan, not because they don't like the taste of meat or because, of anything religious or anything like that, but more because they're worried about the environment. They're worried about all the greenhouse gases that come from livestock. And they might be worried about animal cruelty and the way that a lot of, chickens and other types of animals are farmed in the U.S. So this is really trying to do away with some of those concerns because, frankly, this meat in the lab was never alive to begin with.
And so that brings me to the food that you've been tasting recently, Olga, and that's lab-grown chicken nuggets. First of all, can you explain what lab-grown meat actually is?
Yeah, it's like a little bit of a mind warp. So they actually take real chicken cells and they grow them in this tank called a bioreactor, using nutrients like amino acids and vitamins until they kind of expand basically and multiply and become like almost like a meat, like a ground meat almost kind of product. And then they fry it up and serve it up, and that's your chicken nugget. So it is chicken, but it was never like a chicken like you would see, in a barnyard.
Louisa, I wonder when we think about that, how much of the way we consume meat is about us thinking about the meat that we consume and thinking, oh, it was like a chicken on a farm that was like happily flapping around and now it is not anymore. I mean, do you think we have a good understanding of where our meat comes from?
None whatsoever. And I have to say that I'm so envious that Olga, you got a chance to taste those chicken nuggets, because the team behind that actually has Chicago roots. So I've been following that for a long time, and it's funny because if you see the whole sort of imagery, of like the free range chickens, and even if you go to poultry markets where a lot of people think it's like, oh, you can get the fresher, the better. Most people have absolutely no idea about how chickens get from the living animal to your plate. And don't even get me started with eggs and the chick culling situation, which most people have never heard about either. And so if people had any sort of an idea of where most of our chicken that we eat come from, even at really high-end restaurants, even from some of the best producers, they may seriously consider the lab-grown meat, and early on they were calling it biopsied meat, which I think is...
Yeah, that was clearly a marketing problem there, right?
Exactly. That these alternatives are viable for a lot of those different reasons.
Olga, is that how they're trying to... Is that kind of the marketing pitch behind this as well, when you're talking to the folks who are producing this?
They're really going for, we can make this cheaper and better tasting than regular meat. So their goal is not just to convince the vegetarians and the vegans, but the pitch is really, look, like, even if you don't care at all about animal welfare, but you go to the grocery store and you see, one burger patty that's conventionally raised and slaughtered and one burger patty that we made in the lab, and one of them looks clearly better and it's cheaper, why not go for ours? So they're aiming for the kind of middle ground customer that isn't really as plugged into some of these animal welfare concerns.
Hmm. All right. We have to take a break here, but when we come back, we're just going to wrap up this conversation. Olga, by the way, has been reporting on this for The Atlantic. We will tweet out Olga's story, and there's some interesting videos there, too, other Atlantic videos around this topic of Impossible Foods, the Beyond Burger, and lab-grown meat. Olga Hazan will tweet out her stories. Louisa Chu, co-host of the Chewing Podcast, Chicago Tribune food critic, will be with us as well. If you want to join our conversation, you can text us at 217-394-5765. That's 217-394-5765. Stay tuned. We'll pick up this conversation on the other side of this short break. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Just across the border in St. Louis, Burger King is testing out an Impossible Whopper. That is a plant-based patty that is designed to look and taste just like beef. We've been talking about this growing industry with Olga Hazan. She's been reporting on lab-grown meat as well as the plant-based beef meat, I guess the plant-based baked meat for The Atlantic. Louisa Chu is also with us. She's a Chicago Tribune food critic. She's co-host of the Chewing podcast. She's been telling us a little bit about the Chicago roots of some of these companies as well. You know, as we think about this, Louisa, I wonder how much we think about how much beef especially plays such a big role in our identity as a country. And I'm thinking about, I can't think how many conversations, Louisa, you and I have had on the air about barbecues or cookouts that involve meat. Right. What do you think would either need to happen for either Impossible Burgers or Beyond Burgers or any of these plant-based burgers or lab-grown meat that Olga's been sharing with us to become a bigger part of our mainstream eating? Do you think that's possible?
I think that Olga mentioned it, and it's really the price. And because you can talk all about the environment and ethics and food safety, but it really comes down to the price, where if you can go and you can get a burger that tastes pretty much the same and it's actually a little bit lower, and then there's also the other added benefits. I think those are the things that really tip the scale, because when we talk about the all-American burger, you know, it's no longer just like a plain piece of meat, but it's topped with so many other things. Barbecue is a whole other issue. That hasn't come close to it. But when it comes to burgers, that's really an easy entry point. And then nuggets, you pretty much batter, dip, and deep fry anything. And if you talk about it being a little bit more affordable, and then, again, the other added benefits, those, I think that's already happening. I think that's really already happening in our market.
Olga, when we're thinking about Impossible Foods was founded less than a decade ago, you wrote about how much this lab-grown meat industry has changed in just a fast few years. How do you see these two industries continuing to grow and evolve?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big challenge for so I would say that the plant-based side, the Impossible Foods, is like way further ahead of the lab-grown side. So they haven't actually made a sale yet. The company Just that I kind of profiled, so they're not quite there yet, where they're, you know, you can have an Impossible Burger today if you wanted to, but you know, I got this chicken nugget because I'm a journalist and it was $100. So they're definitely not quite there yet with bringing down the price. And there's been a lot of predictions of like, well, we're going to bring down the price, you know, in 5 years or 10 years. It kind of remains to be seen how quickly that's all going to happen. I think it all just depends on the technology, how much capital they can get, how many bioreactors they can get going, whether there'll be a sacrifice in quality or safety when they start doing that. So I kind of see the plant side taking off first, and then eventually the lab-grown meat side maybe potentially catching up. And, you know, it could be something where they are complementary if they eventually get there, because some people are still going to like the taste of that kind of meaty, kind of gamey taste of, like, you know, a steak or, you know, chicken or something that can't really be replicated necessarily exactly by a plant.
That's Olga Hazan. She's a reporter, D.C.-based reporter for The Atlantic. We'll tweet out Olga's reporting she's been doing on this. And I want to thank Louisa Chu for also being with us. She's with the Chicago Tribune. You can also find her on the Chewing podcast that she co-hosts. Olga, Louisa, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Thank you,
Nyla.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Last week, we talked about an unfortunate designation with the city of Chicago when it comes to migrating birds. Chicago is the deadliest big city in the country for bird deaths while migrating, largely because of the city lights. So here's a more encouraging number. It turns out Chicago has the second highest registered gardens for pollinators in the country. Why is this important to have gardens and yards that are friendly to pollinators? And how can you do this in your garden? Greg Spirius is back in studio with us. He's a research scientist with the Illinois Natural History Survey. Hi, Greg. Welcome back to The 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Nyla. Great to be here.
Mary Phillips is also on the line with us from Washington, D.C., where she's with the National Wildlife Federation's National Pollinator Garden Network. She's the lead coordinator of that in this initiative. They're the ones that gave us those numbers I was just talking about. Hi, Mary. Welcome to The 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Mila. Thank you so much for having us.
So, Mary, this started back in 2015. How did you guys come up with the idea of having people register gardens to be part of this national pollinator network?
Thanks. Yeah. So in 2015, the numbers were increasingly dire for pollinators. And basically, conservation groups, the garden trade sector, and a lot of voluntary civic groups got together and realized if we were going to make a difference in creating habitat, viable habitat for pollinators, we needed to do it at a huge scale. So about 50 organizations since then have gotten together and launched this in 2015 and surpassed 1 million-plus pollinator gardens at year-end 2018.
Wow. So, Greg, I think we should probably, when we mention pollinators, I think everyone thinks of bees, maybe, or butterflies. Can you remind us what pollinators actually are? And they're not also all just insects, right?
Yeah. Anything that brings pollen from one flower to another flower of the same species is a pollinator. So around here, we have hummingbirds. In the desert southwest, in the tropics, bats are very important pollinators. Beetles are often very important pollinators. Mice can be important pollinators in the desert. So, yeah, it's a broad group.
Wow. Well, I don't know that people are making their gardens conducive to mice here in Illinois. Not intentionally, anyway. But, Mary, when we're thinking about gardens, the gardens that you all have registered, are those mostly in urban areas? Are they in suburban areas? Where are you all trying to focus?
Well, yes. So about 1 million acres a year is being developed across the United States. So we're trying to really make sure that habitat is continued to be incorporated into all those populated, developed areas. So I would say a bulk of the gardens that got registered were in urban, suburban areas where obviously there's a lot of people. But we really want to get pollinator gardens across all of North America, really. And we did have a lot of participation from both Canada and Mexico, and particularly along the migratory flyway of the monarch butterfly, which cuts through a lot of the mid part of the United States. Some of that, obviously, there's high populated areas, but a lot of that is also open agricultural and other public land space.
Mm-hmm. Greg, when we think about Illinois and our landscape, how much of Illinois' just the landscape is basically built up urban or suburban areas versus places that would have been natural habitats for these pollinators?
Well, everything would have been natural habitat, but our current Illinois landscape is probably about 15 to 20% urban, suburban, you know, some variation of that. So it's a lot, and it's increasing.
And how has our agricultural land also changed in the way that is all farmland basically friendly to pollinators, or does it depend on the type of farm?
Yeah, it's changed a lot over the years. There's no reason that farmland can't be healthful and beneficial to wildlife and pollinators. But, you know, our farming practices have changed a lot. We've created much more sterile sort of farming landscapes. We've eliminated our hedgerows in between the fields. Our pastures are much different than they used to be. They're much cleaner, I guess you could say. Less flowers.
Why would a hedgerow make a difference?
They're just huge reservoirs for all kinds of plants, and they're good areas for wildlife to hide and to have shelter, basically. It's just habitat, you know, and also food.
Mary, so when people are thinking about if you wanted to have a registered pollinator garden, whether it's for yourself or maybe for a school, what would it need to look like in Illinois? What kind of things would you have to do to qualify?
Oh, sure. So what you'd really want to do is think about planting for 3 seasons and putting in a variety of plants, flowering plants that are providing nectar and forage opportunity for pollinators of all types. And here in the Illinois area, you know, suggesting something like a wild geranium for spring, for summer, the orange butterfly or the rose swamp milkweed, fall goldenrod or New England aster, and also not to forget about the unique kind of blossoms that hummingbirds need, maybe putting in a native trumpet honeysuckle. So that would be like a nice balance of a 3-bloom starter garden for pollinators. But one other really important thing is when you can, and this is getting to the hedgerow concept that Greg was talking about, is putting in shrubs, because shrubs actually support a lot of pollinating insects, so do many trees. And in Illinois, viburnums, an arrowwood or a blackhaw would be really wonderful for the Illinois landscape. And then trees like box elder, maple, are also high pollinator and insect-supporting trees. And the other bonus with all these is many of them berry, so then you're also supporting the bird population that you mentioned at the top of the story.
Hmm. So Mary mentioned milkweeds. Greg, this is probably a good time to remind us that you often say we don't think about weeds in the right way, right? Like weeds are actually good and we shouldn't be maybe ripping them up and throwing them out.
Yeah, a weed is a vague term that means a plant that we don't want growing where it's growing, and it can mean anything. So, you know, when I think of like some of these pollinator gardens, for example, you can think about somebody's lawn, and there are tons of native violets in our lawns if we don't dump tons of herbicides on them, or they're dandelions or something like that, sometimes considered weed, but they can be super important for pollinators and for wildlife.
Mary, if you're someone who's a first-time gardener and maybe the idea of all of these flowers seems intimidating, how would you suggest someone start with maybe even not even thinking about having to have an actual garden, but maybe just thinking about your front yard or your backyard? What would be a good place to start?
So I think especially with folks in smaller spaces, sometimes just doing some container garden on their property, either in big tubs or window boxes, is a nice way to start in getting. I think the key thing is identifying plants. We have a number of resources, a native plant finder that you can do by zip code, and some others that would give you ideas of plants that you could just start out with and do on a small scale.
We will tweet that out and have that at our website. Mary, can I ask you, when you first started this back in 2015, you're now up to more than a million pollinator gardens in the network. Did you think you would get this kind of response?
You know, the first week, yes, because we had so much wonderful exposure. The event was, and the launch was announced at the White House, and it was really terrific. And then, you know, things kind of slowed down. But then what happened is we had so many groups sign on, and really, I think at now we estimate about 8 million people participated this nationwide, well, actually North America-wide, with all the different partners that were rallying, you know, people where they live, work, play, learn, and worship. So it's just been phenomenal. We also had another really exciting kind of visibility moment is when the Empire State Building was lit up in 2017 in the colors of a bee, and we really got the word out. We got 300,000 gardens just within that month registered. It was really a phenomenal response. And one of the things that we realized and people commented is this is something people can do and put these plants in and see results almost immediately. So it's extremely gratifying that they know and see that they can actually help these species right away. They see that they're foraging and they feel the buzz and the life and the color all around them. And we found this to be a really compelling experience for people, both individually as in groups.
Greg, when we're thinking about this, just as we wrap up our conversation here, whether it's bees or butterflies, not all bees and not all butterflies are pollinators, but even if they're not, why do you think it's important that we continue to plant habitat for these species to exist?
Well, most groups of pollinators are in decline in their abundance and diversity. So the more you can do to help bolster their numbers, the better. And I would just like to second Mary's point. I see these pollinator gardens go in, and you can have two beautiful, you know, yards or gardens next to each other. And the one that's got the native plants with following the guidelines is just alive all summer with just life and butterflies, and just it looks amazing. And the one right next to it, you know, it's just kind of, there's nothing there, really. It's really a dramatic effect. So, yeah, the pollinator thing is it's sometimes seen from the perspective of the plant and which is the best animal to bring the pollen to the plant. But, you know, there's also these different things need nectar and they need pollen to eat. So it depends on the species, I guess I would say. That's not a great answer, but...
Greg Spirius has been with us talking a little bit more about the Illinois side of this. He's a research scientist at Illinois Natural History Survey. I want to thank him and Mary Phillips, lead coordinator of the National Pollinator Garden Network. You can still do that. We will have information about how to do that at our website at 21stshow.org. Mary, Greg, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Well, and thank you to Illinois for 25,000 gardens statewide.
That's great. You can go to 21stshow.org, as I mentioned, for more information. We are produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Bobby McSwine is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft, Steve Moore. Tomorrow on the program, State Attorney General Kwame Raoul is going to be joining us, so tune in for that. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.